Hi all, welcome back to Veravox. That was Bon Jovi with You Give Love a Bad Name. This is Veravox episode 5, the third installment of my interview with Simon Templar. It's about an hour long. We begin with recent meetings of classes and major ethical and relational implications and move on to some discussion of recent politics and parallels. Enjoy. All right, Simon, thanks again for being here, for your time. We're doing our third installment now with these different topics and questions. Are you keeping warm?
Yeah, I'm keeping warm, but I haven't had to go out in it or brave that terrible cold today. I did some yesterday, and it was pretty bad. I mean, I was prepared for it, but if you weren't properly dressed or covered up, it wouldn't take long before you'd get really cold. I think the wind chill yesterday was 25 below here, maybe 30 below. Mm-hmm. Not as bad as some places west of us, but still very serious. Mm-hmm. Not something that you should take lightly.
No.
Yeah, you can get frostbite pretty quick. Yeah. If your skin's exposed.
Yeah, they were saying several deaths already attributed to this polar vortex this year. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, but yeah, it hasn't bothered me today because I've been inside and I'm in my study and I've got a space heater going, so I'm protected from it.
I guess the coldness of weather is one thing. The coldness of people is another and sometimes a bigger challenge. As we discussed last time, this installment we're going to move from the local church level up to the classes level and to more recent interactions with classes personnel. I was wondering if you would talk to us a bit about your latest meeting with your classical bureaucrats who were assigned to your case. I think that happened August of 2018, and then they all had a classes meeting in September 2018. If you could describe both of those for us, and then name three big takeaways from each.
Yeah, the meeting with the interim committee, that was the first time that I had met with them face-to-face in 2 years. And remember, immediately following the classes, the special meeting of classes in December of 2015, so that was a little over 3 years ago. Immediately following that meeting, I was assigned an oversight committee, which is, according to the church order, a minister who's been separated from his congregation on the basis of an Article 17, has an oversight committee assigned to him to kind of walk him through the next phases and make sure that everything's okay with him until, to green light him for his next call, so to say. You're not, under a number of circumstances, a minister won't take a call right away after an Article 17 until there's been a psychological evaluation and if there's determination of any work that needs to be done or that sort of thing. So this committee was assigned in December of 2015. And I tried to part company with them some months down the road because it wasn't working. Well, the long story short, two of the members on that committee are also on the interim committee, which assumed oversight of me halfway through this long process. Mm-hmm. And so the meeting that I had with them in the latter part of August, which is what? About 5 months ago now, September, October, November, December, January. Yeah, about 5 to 6 months ago. So it was late August. I went up north and I went with two ministers from the classes where I am now. And they went for support and also as witnesses and also to provide some input and even ask questions of this interim committee. But like I say, it was the first time in 2 years that we had met face to face. And the big reason for the meeting is that I had initiated the process of transferring into this classes where I live now and also moving my membership papers and my ministerial credentials from the church where I pastored. So that process had been going on for a few months. And because there was still unresolved conflict and these pastors in the classes where I am now were apprised of that, we agreed that it would be a good idea to go up there and have a meeting with this committee and try to clear the air and see if we could come to some sort of resolution. So I went up there with a very lengthy timeline of all of the things that had transpired and gone wrong in my interactions with them and with the classes and with my initial oversight committee ever since the fall of 2015. In fact, even before that, some of the preliminary things that led up to the conflict with the council and my termination.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through this timeline with them, you know, the events and with some explanation along the way, and then there was some interaction. So you asked about some big takeaways from that meeting. One of them would be that the men on the committee still didn't get it, and how much that was the case, how tangible or how evident it was that they still didn't get it, even though they knew things weren't right, even though I had written them some lengthy letters the year before explaining what went wrong and how I was very, very ill served by delegates in the classes and also by the committee. The clerk admitted how mishandled my situation was in late 2015. He went into a bit of an explanation about that, both for my benefit and also for the benefit of the ministers who accompanied me. And he said that it was very mishandled. He said that they were shorthanded, that one of the ministers on the interim committee at that time had left, and he and the regional pastor, who was part of this four-person committee who met with me, both he and the regional pastor admitted that I was not well served and that they blew it. And so I might have said it at the meeting, I don't remember right now, but of course, real obvious question is, where was all of this 6 months ago or 8 months ago? You know, there were none of these kind of admissions prior to this, and yet at the same time, they knew that. They knew they were scrambling. They knew they were shorthanded. They knew that there were some holes in the committee that hadn't been filled. And they knew that I was very bothered by their inefficiency and by the way I had been treated. They knew all of that. I had made it really clear to them. And yet this admission didn't come until this meeting. Mm-hmm. So I guess another big takeaway is one man in particular on this committee, who was also on my original oversight committee. He's a guy that I had some real problems with, some real issues with. And I actually made a list of six or seven things which he said that were noteworthy. And I guess all I can say to sum all of that up, his attitude, his demeanor, his perspective, his reaction to things, you know, keep going, you know, roll it all up. It's just a disaster case. He never should have been on a committee overseeing me. I mean, I felt that way prior to this meeting. Other things that happened along the way indicated that to me, but this meeting just confirmed it in spades. We got into a discussion about how that committee wanted to interview members from churches I served 20 years ago. And in that discussion, I reminded him and the others present that a very significant denominational authority said that that was out of bounds. This is an expert on church polity. I won't mention his name.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that this kind of thing was out of bounds. They shouldn't be doing that. And this guy just flat out said he didn't care. I don't care what he said. We're going to do what we think's best. And then he even said that Pastor Church Resources, which is another denominational support team, that this outfit had given him the green light to do whatever he felt necessary. And so I hear this and I think, now it's very easy to misconstrue somebody saying, you know, do what you feel you have to or do what you think's necessary. Now, does that mean you get carte blanche to do anything you want to do with this minister that you're supposedly providing oversight for?
Right. So, well, and what is his training and expertise for conducting interviews and for deciding whether what they want to do is within their mandate.
Oh, and that even, you know, we can go and may possibly go down a rabbit trail here, but talking about interviewing, you know, one of the things that was explicit in my termination agreement was that parties were not to say disparaging things about each other. The minister is not supposed to say disparaging things about the church, and likewise the church about the minister, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, I find out from him that he had been talking to and interviewing a bunch of people at my former church.
Mm-hmm.
And that some of them had said negative things, or there were lots of problems, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's a violation of the termination agreement. But anyway, he got loud and belligerent at the meeting. He told me that it was God's will that I have that particular oversight committee that I had.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so that, you know, when we were going through the timeline, I traced out why I had problems with that committee. I gave specific examples of how they wouldn't explain things to me. They wouldn't answer my questions. I even provided some excerpts from our correspondence. And so then, of course, all that led up to the time where I said I was done with that committee. I didn't want to work with them anymore. I wanted the classes to appoint another committee because it wasn't working. And so he had this response of, it was God's will that I have that particular oversight committee.
Was it also God's will that they be recalcitrant, obstinate, and incompetent? Is that his fault?
Yeah, so I mean, the statement raises a lot of questions and a lot of theological issues, doesn't it?
Well, does it nullify their responsibility to maintain their duty of care toward you and try to do a good job, both according to standards of professionalism and biblical standards, as well as that in the church order?
Well, there's that. When I met with the brass from Grand Rapids, I met with some highly placed people in Grand Rapids and told them what had been going on with this committee and that I wanted another committee. I also corresponded with the man that I made reference to a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. the church polity expert, and they all understood why I wanted to be done with that committee and supported me in my attempt to get another committee appointed. But none of them said, it's God's will that I have that particular oversight committee.
Well, it's interesting. Like you said, it raises interesting questions. Why didn't Aetna bear with you or go about asking you to leave a different way, since clearly it was God's will that you be there?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if that's the route you want to take, that whatever happens is God's will, and I didn't discuss this at length with him in that meeting. You know, there wasn't time to really pick that apart and tease out all the implications, but everything that happens comes under the heading of God's will of decree.
Mm-hmm.
And so according to the will of decree, yeah, it was God's will that I have that committee. But was it his perfect will? Was it something that he wanted? Was it even his prescriptive or moral will?
Right.
Well, the only thing you know is that it's his will of decree and the fact that he allowed it to happen. But mm-hmm. it is noteworthy that nobody else said that. He's the only one that said that. And so if we can take it another step, we could ask the question, so given that that's his attitude, it's God's will that I have that committee, well, then what's his attitude going to be when I'm unhappy with how it's going and I would like the classes to consider appointing another committee? What's his attitude going to be? Well, no way, it was God's will.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I don't want to go along with that, then what? Well, I'm out of the will of God. See, I'm opposing the will of God because I don't want to work with this committee any longer.
It's problematic.
So, I mean, this is just, pardon?
It's problematic because if you're going to talk about God and what he wants and his oversight and sovereignty, one question you would have to ask is, well, did what the committee did and how they behaved please God?
Right. Yeah, does God's will in that sense ever change or in that connection? Should we question anything? Because it's all God's will, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I mean, we're focusing on this guy because that's a big takeaway from this meeting. It's him, what he did, his attitude, the things he said, his mindset. All of that was just more indication, more evidence that he should never have been on this committee.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started to say that he a few minutes ago that he had talked to a lot of people. And this is something he reiterated. He probably said this three times. Well, I talked to a lot of people. There were lots of people who had problems with me. And he sat back in his chair and, you know, kind of looked, put his head up and sat back in his chair. And there were lots of people. So in that situation, you know, what are you supposed to say? I mean, I've got these guys from class of Zealand with me. And then there are the other guys on his interim committee. Now, what are we supposed to get into this and ask, okay, well, how many are lots of people and who are they and what were their problems? Mm-hmm. You know, this is so general and so sweeping. And then he made reference to a letter that he had in his computer. This was from a young woman who had left the church, and the letter went back to the winter of 2012. And so she left and she wrote a letter to the council explaining why she was leaving, and it contained some criticism of me. Now, I never saw this letter. No one told me about this letter. And when this woman left, she never talked to me. So you have to ask the question, why did she send this letter to the council, which contained criticism of me without ever talking to me about it? And then what in the world is this guy doing with this letter? And not only that, it's on his computer.
This is so inappropriate to pass around this triangulating communication without ever informing the person the criticism concerns.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
Yep. And on our way home, of course, we had a lengthy drive home, and the three of us discussed what had transpired in this meeting. The meeting lasted about 2 hours. It took about that long to go through the timeline and kick some of the stuff around. But one of the ministers in the class that's where I am now, he said, you know, this guy talked about that letter on his computer like he was proud of it. He said, he shouldn't be proud of that letter. He said, that's nothing that you should be bragging about. What's he doing with that letter and the fact that it's on his computer? So they were taken aback by that. I mean, they got it too, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's both inappropriate, but then, well, it's inappropriate, but it also makes you wonder about his motivations. Why is he so interested in it? He's gotten too personally invested in your case. It's quite weird. And his.
Oh yeah, he's almost. I'm gonna say this advisedly, but you know the expression, he's got it in for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt like he had it in for me. And he was going to prove it, and I was going to pay, or I was going to dance his dance because I'm guilty of X, Y, Z, or I have these deficiencies. And this guy knew it because he talked to people, and he's got this letter in his computer. So I guess a third takeaway is one of the other delegates who had also been on my oversight committee. This guy, clearly, he really hadn't learned his lesson. He still didn't indicate that he listened or was trying to understand me. At certain points, he played amateur psychologist. There were a couple of aha moments on his part, but he tried to defend his behavior and his unwillingness to respond to my letters or give me a straight answer. He tried to defend himself by saying that when people tried to write to me, I picked their words apart or something like that. But, you know, it never really happened to him, but that was kind of an accusation. But see, all this stuff is just, it's just said in the form of an assertion or an opinion, but you don't really have time to address it or get to the bottom of it.
Right.
So.
Yeah, well, it's probably another example in the category of if you try to defend yourself, somehow you're a bad guy, or you make the people who are attacking you feel attacked, and that's the reality somehow, rather than you have a spine or you have a defense and you're willing to push back. And people who don't have an argument or don't have a justification for their decisions or their actions are threatened by it or incapable of defending or justifying themselves. And so, of course, they'll find a way to put it back on you so that they don't have to admit that they don't know what they're doing or that they messed up.
Right. And of course, I guess an implicit objection to some of the issues they raise is, where was all this months ago? I mean, if this is this guy's opinion and he thinks it's a legitimate problem or a legitimate reason not to answer my questions or respond to my letters, then why didn't he say that before? Why am I finding out? You know, we had our meeting, the last meeting that we had when they were my oversight committee, we had that in August of 2016. And mm-hmm. I followed that up with some rather pointed letters to them, at least two to follow up in the next couple of months, and never heard back from them, never got any answers. Well, I got one reply from him, and that was basically, I'm not going to talk to you. Nothing that I say will change your mind, so I'm just not going to discuss it. So, yeah, great.
You can only speculate because you can't ask them why directly and expect an answer. But what it seems like is, or a conclusion you can draw, is that this wasn't really serious enough to be upfront with these opinions with you. You don't matter enough to engage with. And the situation, even though they know it's a problem and that there's a rift there, that's not serious enough to address and try to resolve. They were right. happy with it to just go on as it was.
Oh, yeah, because it shouldn't have taken all this time. They weren't prepared to invest that kind of time in it.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing this was about is coming up with steps for me to accomplish. And then once I did everything that they told me to do, or accomplished all these goals or steps or jumped through whatever hoops, once I'm done with that, then I submit a report and they sign off on it, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't take all this time or discussion or interaction or explaining of themselves. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah. So then the next, I guess, part B is the big takeaways from the class this meeting, which I didn't attend, but I talked to the regional pastor who was there, who gave me some observations from his attendance to it. But when they talked about my case, they went into another executive session, and I guess that executive session lasted about an hour.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you should describe an executive session.
Yeah, the executive session is when the classes meet, it's an open meeting, so people can attend and hear the deliberations and the presentations and all that. But if there is matter of a confidential nature, then the classes can declare an executive session. And at that point, all of the non-delegates leave the room, and only the delegates are there to deliberate about what goes on. And of course, it's supposed to be confidential. So in the case of someone like me, I'm going to say that the discussions pertaining to me, I should be apprised of what they talked about. In fact, I should also be allowed to be in on the meeting mm-hmm. if I want to, because it's about me. You ought not to have a forum where people can make accusations or lodge complaints or express criticisms, and the person on the receiving end doesn't even get to hear it or defend themselves. I don't think that's appropriate. At any rate, they had one of those executive sessions, and I guess the funny thing is that I had sent a communication to the classes expressing my desire to take an early retirement, and so it should have been, I would think, not a very lengthy discussion, but for whatever reason, they talked about me and the situation for about an hour, and they did approve my request to take an early retirement, and the regional pastor also said in this executive session that the classes had made a number of mistakes, had mishandled some things with me, and that the classes owed me an apology. In fact, he had told me beforehand, he had said that to me several times, the classes owes you an apology and they should make a public apology to you because of how this was mishandled and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Said that more than once. Well, then he raised the issue at the classes meeting, and the response was, someone said, when's he going to apologize to us?
Mm-hmm. For what? You may never know.
Yeah, yeah. So he didn't get any traction. I think that was the word he used. He didn't get any traction with that request.
It's interesting how you as one disabled, ostracized person can victimize the entire classes.
Yeah. Doesn't it raise the question, if somebody feels like they've been offended, or that in some way I've done something inappropriate, doesn't it seem like this or that person should tell me?
Oh, Simon. But we know people don't deal with things. They just talk about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I thought that was really striking. When's he going to apologize to us? Okay, for what?
Somebody's feeling sorry for himself.
Yeah. And so then, I guess one other takeaway, and this wasn't pertaining to the meeting per se, but a rather unusual note shortly after the meeting, I got a cheerful note from the clerk of classes, who's also part of that interim committee, but the note said that they approved my retirement, and it was really one of the most friendly, upbeat notes that I had received from him or from anyone on the committee. So I thought that was interesting, too.
Mm-hmm.
The tone, the friendliness, and that sort of thing that had really been missing up until that point, up until I asked to take an early retirement. So
that is interesting. Yeah, so, what do you make of that?
He was glad to be done with me. I don't know.
No more skin in the game.
Maybe too, the fact that we had that lengthy debriefing in August and he had his eyes open to some things, maybe that helped him to see things more clearly or help him to put me in a different, it helped to put me in a different perspective that maybe I wasn't just an obstinate, stubborn guy who was bucking the system. That was, I think, his perception of me until we had that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But there was such a marked contrast in his note, the tone of it and the style from what he had written before and from what others in those positions had written. It was very noticeable. So,
yeah.
But yeah, other than that, not much else to say about the classes meeting. I don't know, are you recalling anything in particular from stuff that I had documented about that previously? Or?
Well, one thing I reflect on often is that was the last in a string of meetings where you weren't allowed to be present, where people were discussing your case and making decisions about you. And people who were there confirmed that disparaging, even slanderous remarks were made about you, which was affecting the group's perception, affecting people's decision-making and judgment about you, and how contrary that is to Western jurisprudence, as well as to biblical standards of just how you treat someone. And amongst Christians, that's so, you use the word unethical, but it's also flagrantly irresponsible, especially when the person has already expressed concerns about the way his case is being handled, and people should know better than to stand around and gossip about someone who is in their power in that way. And they keep doing it. They keep doing it every time, and then you're not even allowed to know after the fact what was said about you. And on top of that, never given a platform to provide any defense. But how could you defend yourself against accusations you're never permitted to hear? So and none of this is documented either, so there's no way to get proper redress, even if they were to offer it to you. So it's all fouled up.
Yeah, it is a very flawed procedure, very inappropriate to close the doors and just have a free-for-all where anyone can say some fool thing or make some allegation, and you can't know if you're on, like I said, if you're on the receiving end of it, you can't know what it is, you can't address it, there's no cross-examination.
That people allege that you have personality problems or that you're dishonest, and you're never supposed to even know that, much less be able to counter it or demand that somebody prove it or retract it. And it's just disgusting.
Yeah, it is. It's reminiscent, you know, one of the terms you can use for this kind of procedure is the star chamber. Yeah, but these are all violations of due process, basic justice, even biblical justice, the whole business of being able to face your accusers.
And having witnesses, everything is made clear, who said what and when, and giving a person the opportunity to defend himself.
Yep.
Well, I guess due process is a good segue into my next question. So back in September of 2018 was the circus of confirmation hearings for now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. It was interesting to me.
That's putting it mildly. Yeah, the circus.
Maybe the it was more like the games, gladiatorial games, lots of mess and blood. It was really interesting to me that the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for the confirmation of Kavanaugh and all that drama and the allegations made by Christine Blasey Ford and those other people, which have now all been proven made up, they were coming to a head around the same time as that Classes meeting, for example, was taking place. Did you see any similarities between your cases at the time?
Yeah, it's interesting that what we were just talking about really tempts me to swing a leg over that old hobby horse and really go for a ride, you know, about the justice and how inappropriate the executive session is and you know, the matters we discussed with regard to due process.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to say, too, before comparing my situation to Brett Kavanaugh, his situation is obviously much more serious than mine. He had a lot more to lose. It's a much, much greater and egregious miscarriage of justice, what was done to him.
Mm-hmm.
You used the word circus. It's a miscarriage of justice. It was an abomination. It was a fiasco. It was all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the first similarity when I think about that is that people can make accusations or allegations, and there seems to be a lack of interest in evidence or proof.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the allegation or the accusation is so juicy. And there's an initial fascination when the accusation's made, but then when the accused issues a flat denial, the people in charge don't want to dig in and get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get a flat denial. No, it didn't happen. Not even close. A complete and utter denial. But when it comes to digging in and really finding out what actually happened, we don't want to do that. So in my case, I urged the delegates at the special classes meeting in 2015, in December, I urged them to get at the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I asked them, investigate this. Please get at what really happened. And there was no interest in that. And it didn't matter to them because the deed had already been done. You know, I've already been terminated. And what do you want to do that for? Well, because I had been slandered. I was the object of slander. It mattered to me that the truth be told.
Mm-hmm.
And that false statements, accusations about me that weren't true, that those be rectified. I wanted the truth known, and I wanted the record set straight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, very frankly, I was slandered. Dishonest things were said about me. The truth was distorted. The picture was painted in a negative light. You know, and some of that was frankly done by Keith Manis.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of that was his own getting carried away or embellishing, and how much of that was fed to him by other people, I don't know. But he painted the picture. He was the one who wrote the document that was inaccurate. But same thing happened to Brett Kavanaugh. He was slandered. So do people really believe that this Blasey Ford woman, for example, that she was afraid of lying? That came up the week that they were going to interview her, and she pushed it to the end of the week, and there was something about her being afraid of flying. And, you know, then it comes out weeks later that she's jetted all over the world for her vacations and her other job-related jaunts to Hawaii and Europe and the Bahamas and, I think, Mexico. And she's done this numerous times. Well, are we really supposed to believe that she has this fear of flying? And that would just be just one example of how her word is highly questionable. So a number of issues discredited her, but that didn't matter to the people who opposed Brett Kavanaugh. None of that mattered. You know, another thing is when the people who do these kind of things, when they're caught, nothing's done about it.
Nope. Just move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in your situation, it very much seemed an example of postmodern acceptance of people's perspective as the truth or as good as the truth. And that's just not the case. Well, people really felt strongly that this was so. I'm sorry that doesn't make it so. And when it comes to ruining someone's reputation or ending their career, people's perceptions isn't good enough. There needs to be justification of those perceptions, i.e. you need to have proof that somebody was doing the things they're alleged to have done that are egregious or punishable.
Yeah, it's very postmodern. That's crossed my mind many times in discussing what happened here or with Brett Kavanaugh, the very postmodern perspective. And it's like, we're not allowed to ask, yeah, you've had this perception, this is your perception, but is your perception valid? Is mm-hmm. it rooted in reality? Do you even have a right to have that perception?
Mm-hmm. Validity is not a question. There isn't much of a spirit of inquiry anyway, but certainly you don't question the validity or accuracy of people's recollections or their impressions or their allegations. I would have said that maybe it was all just laziness and fear of rocking the boat or fear of losing more people. Well, we're being extorted. People are threatening to leave and we can't lose them, so it's easier to just fire the pastor. Laziness, okay. But that wasn't what I got from people, and it wasn't what I got from Keith Manis. There was an attempt to claim that both sides had merit, or that both sides had a Christian worldview or were operating from Christian principles, and that both sides had had some truth. Well, even in the Article 17 document, he acknowledges that you weren't guilty of any wrongdoing, but people felt X, Y, and Z. And there's a tacit admission in that inclusion or in the listing of people's perceptions as grounds, that perceptions are enough.
Right. Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind when you say that is somebody accused me of being controlling.
Mm-hmm.
And I reject that and disavow that completely. So yeah, I mean, you have this perception that I'm controlling. Well, then what we have to get at is, do you have any basis for that? This is a feeling you have. This is a perception you have. Mm-hmm. Is this rooted in reality? And do we have a right to say, you don't have any right to that perception?
Mm-hmm.
It's baseless. It's groundless.
Mm-hmm.
But in today's world, it's anathema to even think that. To tell somebody you have no right to that perception, oh, nobody would want to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that's the case. Sometimes a perception is formed about somebody that's wrong or mm-hmm. very unfair.
It's bad mm-hmm. enough that their judgment was clouded, but they were also demanding that action be taken on the basis of their bad judgment or their mm-hmm. their flawed perceptions. I remember talking to one of the women I interviewed in person in October of 2015, and I asked her very direct questions when she'd make an assertion about what was happening or what you were doing that she didn't think was correct. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, what about this? I think maybe she was talking about the preaching and either things mm-hmm. being negative or not being uplifting. And so I'd give her several examples of mm-hmm. the passages and topics you'd preached, and that the objectively, you know, just listening to your words and never mind your actual tone, or looking at the series of sermons in context, and the fact that overall they're quite positive, but even just the text of one message on its own is demonstration that they weren't getting what number 13 was asserting you were preaching all the time. And
right.
She had this odd, oh, how to describe it, sort of glazed over look in her eye. Not quite glazed over. It's really hard to describe. Like she'd slowly been receding from the conversation, but she just said, well, I know what I feel.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that is an admission that all the facts that I bring to the table don't matter and are
right.
not going to change your mind. Because you are going off of your emotion
yeah.
and your impressions, and yeah. reality doesn't have anything to do with it. And somehow
yeah,
that's still supposed to be your fault.
Yeah. This is an extremely significant subject. People having their feelings, their impressions, their subjective take on how something is, and you don't dare question that or say that that's misguided. Or that, like I said a minute ago, and believe me, I know how people will react to that, that the average person today will really get reactive and say, how dare you tell me how to feel when you say you don't have any right to feel that way? They will get flat bent out of shape. But I'm telling you, there are times when it's valid to say that.
Mm-hmm.
When it's appropriate to say that, you have a wrong perception of this. You're looking at this the wrong way. You know, mm-hmm. One thing that comes to mind is a discussion years ago I had with somebody, and this person and I were on the phone, and this person was making some, I don't know, accusations is too strong a word, but I disagreed with the person, or I brought up, I very politely, not in a snarky way, but I brought up a counterexample to prove the point that what this person was saying wasn't true. And the person wanted to cut off the conversation and said that I was bullying.
Mm-hmm.
Said, "You're bullying me." Now, I had somebody else in the room with me at the time, just 5 feet away, listening to this phone call. And when I hung the phone up, the person said to me, "You did not. There was no way that what you just did could be construed as bullying."
Mm-hmm.
But you see, in this person's mind, you know, the other person on the other end of the phone, any disagreement, see, is bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I have to ask the question, is that objectively true? That when you disagree with somebody or you point out, no, that's really not what happened. Bully, you bully.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not being a bully. But that's where we are today. Mm-hmm. And so it's very postmodern, subjective, feeling oriented, as opposed to logical, rational, let's look at the facts.
Mm-hmm.
We don't live in that environment anymore like we did 50 or 60 years ago.
Right. Well, and so, it also makes reception the determiner of original intent or meaning of a text or speech. So if we're sound and orthodox, let's say, in terms of our view on the Bible has an objective value and meaning in and of itself, and how we read it does not determine what its meaning or value is.
Right.
But
right.
This sort of approach, meaning or intent, is determined by people's reception of what's said or written. And
yeah,
so
it's a reader-centered hermeneutic,
mm-hmm.
rather than a text-centered or an author-centered hermeneutic.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then another dimension of this, and you know, we can move on to the next observation I have about Kavanaugh, but I'll throw this one in really quick. Because we're so into this mindset, people are now predisposed to resist or to resent somebody who disagrees with them.
Well, and they can turn it into a personal attack.
Sure. I mean, the most nasty, one of the nastiest things you can say to somebody is, "You're wrong." Nobody's wrong anymore, huh?
I guess that sort of naturally follows from, as you said, a reader-based or reception or receiver-oriented hermeneutic. If you're the creator of meaning, then of course any disagreement on the meaning of something is going to be taken personally.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it's the fact that's at issue, then anybody could be mistaken, and so you should be open to having your understanding challenged.
Mm-hmm.
But
yep.
And that's too rational.
Mm-hmm. Well, another observation I had about that is, having made the comparison about accusations or allegations, and not a lot of energy to try to get at whether it really happened. But it's the those who have these issues or these concerns, they don't go to the party involved. Or if there's bad behavior that really should be reported, they wait 40 years.
Yeah.
Now, in my case, it didn't take that long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the situation with Kavanaugh, this woman could have come forward years ago, even at the point where he was, was he appointed to a circuit court? He had another high appointment some years back. And so he was in the news. And,
yeah, I think
and
Ninth
she could
circuit.
Have come forward then.
Mm-hmm.
And so could the other accusers.
Right.
Now, you know, in my case, there were people who supposedly had issues, but I knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the young woman who wrote the letter that the guy had on his computer.
Right.
You know, I don't think there were many like her, but there were some people who wanted to lodge a complaint at the time of my suspension, but they never came to me.
Well, they didn't want to do it the proper way. You know, going to the police and pressing charges is going to require a quantum of evidence. Coming to you with issues is probably going to require them being specific and offering a proper articulate challenge. And if you have an answer, or say, well, this isn't what I've intended, or this just isn't so. Or if it comes down to a disagreement on a doctrinal issue, you know, sure. people aren't going to want to do that. It's much easier to wait for a champion who's going to go to the tournament and strike you down on their behalf without them ever having to say or deal with anything themselves.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of the former elders who had issues with me. But now how do you go to a pastor in a supposedly Bible-believing Reformed church where the denomination is still pretty consistent on that issue? How do you go to him and say, well, I don't agree with you on homosexuality. I think it's okay. I don't think the Bible's right about that. Well, yeah, it's going to be kind of an uncomfortable conversation, isn't it? So, yeah, I don't think there were many like the young woman who wrote the letter, but there were some who had complaints. They never came to me. And so how do you know the issues are real if there's no opportunity to discuss the problem?
Well, and when people tend to triangulate or sit on their frustrations, things tend to get distorted or grow over time.
Sure. So you just get together and churn the water, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the person who's in a position to do something about it or to clear the air, you never talk to him.
Yeah. I'm disappointed that that woman went so far as to write something without even addressing it to you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Understand it.
It's
I didn't know I had problems with her, you know?
It's not Christian. It's more corporate. Like, I want to talk to your manager, or I want the number of your regional supervisor.
Yeah, and just going a little bit further with what you said about talking to each other, this reminds me of somebody that I was quite close friends with when I lived up there. But this woman is a long-time resident in the community, knows the community and grew up in that particular denomination, so she knows the ethos of it and all that. But more than once, she said, people up there, they talk to each other about the problem, but they don't talk to the person. They talk about the person to each other when they've got a problem with somebody. Mm-hmm. They talk about him, but they don't talk to him.
Right. Well, one of the elders who was on council in 2015 agreed or had a similar exchange with you, if I remember right. He said, that's true.
Yep.
That's true. We talk about people or about an issue rather than to the person or trying to address it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, this woman is a very observant person, very, very intuitive and observant and all that. But she was very adamant about that. And I remember her saying that several times. On different occasions about the community, talk about people. We don't talk to them.
Well, that's why when things finally come to a head, it tends to be a storm, a very messy storm. Things getting thrown around, things being done hastily or inappropriately because people are desperate for some kind of resolution or catharsis after there's been all the gossip mongering and backbiting.
Yep, things hit critical mass, and then it blows apart, and then it takes a while to get back to homeostasis.
Yeah.
Those are all the things you learn in the family systems counseling literature.
Yeah.
So another observation I had is there's this thing called the mob mentality. A mob mentality can develop. It's so easy to jump on the bandwagon when someone is accused and they look guilty or I think they did something. And everybody's all agitated and jumping up and down about it. So it's easy to join in the attack.
Mm-hmm.
We saw this recently in the news here with the high school kids from Kentucky.
Yeah, the Covington Gate.
Yeah, yeah. People Twittering and Instagramming or whatever it is they do, weighing in because they saw a piece of video, the context, the background about which they knew nothing, and yet they're accusing these kids of inciting or fomenting conflict or
disrespect, you know, seems to be the crime.
Yeah, they're accusing these kids of rabble-rousing and harassing this Native American, and also there were a group of blacks there, the black Hebrew Israelites, and it turns out that the white 15-year-olds from Covington were the best behaved of the bunch.
Standing around waiting for their bus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if it's personal, I mean, as far as people getting into the mob mentality, if it's personal, or if there's some reason that people in the group think you're a threat, or if they have something to gain, they'll take sides. They'll jump aboard, or they'll take up the cause, even if they have no evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of an interesting parallel, the mob mentality. And I guess maybe one more thing is how the accused person is placed under a microscope, and you watch very carefully how he handles false accusations.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to monitor this guy, and what you find is that when you defend yourself against slander, mm-hmm. that makes you defensive.
Right, or that's evidence that you're guilty. I had someone use that argument on a completely unrelated issue. But if accusations make you upset, then that must mean you're guilty. How can that be proof you're guilty? Because if you're falsely accused, wouldn't that upset you? Clearly she hadn't thought this through.
How does it follow logically that being indignant because you're falsely accused means that you're guilty?
Yeah.
Yep. So you're not supposed to defend yourself, and heaven forbid if you get angry or indignant when people lie about you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just supposed to be non-emotional and detached, like it's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can do that, if you can just act like a robot, like it doesn't bother you,
probably people would accuse you of being
some pathology too,
right? You'd be a sociopath, or ooh, he's so cold. You know, there's mm-hmm. no doubt in my mind that he molested hundreds of women without any feeling about it.
Yeah, notice how detached he is, and how unresponsive, and how cold he is, and you know, what does that say about him? So yeah, you know, you're wrong no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
and you're not supposed to get indignant or angry or upset if the lies are of such a nature that they could jeopardize your career or ruin your reputation,
or if, like Brett Kavanaugh, you've got two young daughters who are going to know that their father faced this for the rest of their lives.
Yep.
And was accused of arranging gang rapes at parties. One thing I was going to say, because we talked about this phenomenon before, maybe in the earlier stages of the classist stuff, but confirmation bias, you know, the putting the accused under the microscope, anything he does, people are going to interpret as evidence that they're already right, because they already know he's guilty.
Sure,
so
I can go in, make it really, really clear, really simple. Go in with the assumption, I know he has a pathology.
Mm-hmm.
So now, anything that he does, I'm going to try to determine what the pathology is based on this given cluster of so-called symptoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I remember something that's come up a lot with the classes people is that you need to be cooperative. There's an assumption, there's an assumption from the beginning that you are difficult, even though they hadn't worked with you. But it was something that was in place early on, such that any questions you asked or any resistance you offered to their harebrained ideas was going to be seen as you being uncooperative, and therefore confirmation that everything that had already been alleged against you was true.
Exactly. There's the fact, the issue itself is offensive. To be put in the position where you can't question anything, you can't disagree, you can't offer your own opinion, when you're put in that position right away where you're afraid to express yourself, afraid to say what's on your mind, that's terrible. That's bad enough. But to just have this assumption that we have to be on the lookout for this, you know, how did we even get to the point where my being uncooperative was an issue? How did that even come up? Where'd
mm-hmm.
this come from? Where'd this notion come from that I'm uncooperative? Yeah. Yep.
Just another question to which you can't get a straight answer, because none of the people who've had the power to say and do all these things have had to explain anything. You don't know where these things come from or why they think the way they do.
Yeah. Yeah, that in itself is at least odd. I was going to use a couple other words. I won't. But it goes against so much of training that I've had in life when I was in the business world or even before in ministry. And that is supervisors or people that I reported to saying, you know, if you disagree, speak up. If you have an opinion that may not be popular, speak up. You know, say what's on your mind. Don't be afraid. You know, there's a time when you have to stand up and be counted. You know, if you think you're right, stand up and say so. I had a boss tell me that in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you think you're right, stand up. Say so. Speak up.
Right. Yeah. So I've had that. I mean, in my limited career experience, you have to say mm-hmm. that as a teacher as well, because you as a teacher make mistakes. And I've had students who caught a mistake, well, more than one mistake over the years, and they weren't afraid to raise their hands and say, isn't that actually this word, or isn't that a subjunctive? Oh yeah. And if they hadn't said something, if I were right. too tyrannical, right. then everyone would have gone home with the right. wrong answer.
Yep. Yeah, and you can run your classroom or engineer it in such a way where it's either a spoken or an unspoken rule that you don't ever question me.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way in the church.
Certainly not. And like my former boss in the business world said, you know, if you think you're right, if you see something, this could be critical to an order. You know, we could wind up running this order all wrong and have to throw out this product. And part of it's going to be because you didn't speak up.
Yeah,
if you were afraid to disagree with everybody.
Yeah, there's in that case, there's a sense that if you know something, you have uh-huh. a responsibility to use that knowledge for the benefit of the team
exactly.
in which you're operating.
Yep.
But yeah, these guys were a bit, where did, this despotic attitude come from? I mean, again, Christians shouldn't be afraid to admit they're wrong. They should be the first, because we all know we're sinners and we should expect a gracious attitude. But I almost think that people who are afraid to admit they're wrong, maybe it's because they're ungracious with other people. So is it actually fear of you attacking them, or is it because, well, maybe it also is that they know they don't have a leg to stand on, but their swaggering tyranny goes hand in hand with their own proclivities to cutting down or criticizing other people, which
mm-hmm.
they did to you, especially when it was clear that they didn't understand you, or that there was this gap in perspective. Then you really became something alien and somebody
mm-hmm.
who had to be put in his place. So then there really was a fear that admitting they're wrong would give you some sort of power over them. But they were the ones who were concerned about power. You just wanted a fair process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
some honesty and transparency.
Yeah, it raises the question, what kind of people do you want in the organization? Do you want just a bunch of yes men? And boy, for students of history, that word yes men, that carries a very bad connotation.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can think of a variety of political regimes where the dictator had a bunch of yes men around him, and it resulted in disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You right,
don't question
you,
my authority.
Well, and you don't have any respect for those sorts of people either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Frustrating.
So what do you think? Do you think that pretty well wraps up Brett Kavanaugh? I don't have a lot of other input, but it is a really interesting comparison. And, you know, his case is one of a number of examples of injustice or people being unfairly attacked.
Well, and one thing we haven't touched on yet, the self-righteousness and virtue signaling of the accusers or people jumping on the bandwagon. It's not just, we're going to take him down, or we know he's a horrible person. It's, look how wonderful we are. We're so brave because we're attacking him. And I think again about the classes and their committees taking the time to praise themselves in their reports of their activities. Well, we've all done such a good job. Let's applaud one another and give each other a pat on the back and a little gold star. It's just that I thought was so odd, them not only reporting on their activities, but approving of themselves. That was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, agreed.
Offered some interesting insight into their approach and their opinions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also quite disturbing because of their age and because they're leaders in the church, and they don't see that. They're not reflective enough to realize how that sounds, especially to the person they're not treating well.
Yeah. Well, somebody pointed out in one of their documents, the words were, we can be thankful for the way we handled this, basically how they said it. Mm. And a person critiquing the document said, this is cringeworthy. Mm. We are thankful for ourselves.
Yeah.
You really want to say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, of course, I had an interchange with one of the people on the interim committee, one of those guys that left 3 years ago. And he said that the work of the church visitors was good work and that they handled it well. And I came back at him in writing and I said, how do you know that? And I said, wouldn't it be good to talk to some of the parties involved? Because I don't think it was handled well at all. And he never explained himself. He finally, after about 3 or 4 attempts, I asked him where he got that from. And he said, from their report, from the church visitors' report. But I had to prod him. I had to ask the question at least 3 times, maybe 4 times before he finally gave me an answer. But he never acknowledged the problem with him saying that it was well handled when A, he didn't know, and B, he didn't ask people who were right at the center of it.
Right.
Hey, you know, how do you think that went? How do you think they handled it? And I would have told him, I don't think it was well handled at all. And it's not to pick on those guys, but it's just an example of somebody weighing in with that opinion, like you said, of how great we are.
Well, and usually you don't, I mean, you do want people to reflect on their own performance sometimes, but that's not what you evaluate them. That's not how you evaluate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's like asking so we always would get evaluated based on student feedback, and you always tried to make this list of teachers ranked as excellent. That's like teachers being ranked as excellent because they think they're excellent rather than asking the students to mm-hmm. give feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's just so silly.
Yeah.
But also, I thought modesty, so often, you know, it can be a false modesty, but humility, I thought, was a Christian virtue. Why are people running around talking about what a good job they did, especially when they know the person at the center of the activity is not happy? That's so mm-hmm. strange.
Yeah. I still say my biggest frustration with that, with my interaction with him and also with a couple other people along the same lines, is even when it's pointed out to them, there's no acknowledgement and there's no engagement.
Mm-hmm. maybe because if they actually hear you and think about it, they realize it's quite silly to just take people's word for it
mm-hmm.
in a situation that's this complicated and, as it turns out, controversial.
Yeah, yeah. Or just something as simple as saying, I talked out of turn.
Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to admit even things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's embarrassing. But perhaps on these bitter notes, it would be wise to close and leave some last overall reflections for our next episode.
Yeah, there was something about conflict of interest, various conflicts of interest, and why that was an issue.
Yeah, I think we
under
could
these circumstances. Yeah,
I think that would be a good follow up. But just because that's such a big topic in itself, and we've gone just over a bit over an hour, maybe
okay.
be best to open with that, because I'm sure we can go a lot of different directions with all the conflicts of interest that come up. I thought we'd do a rapid fire game show kind of listing and see how many we can come up with on the fly.
What were those old game shows? I used to watch those a long time ago. The $10,000 pyramid and match game. anyway.
Yeah, not quite 21. So yeah, there's just three questions left. I think one more episode and we'll be able to get through them all. And yeah, start with conflicts of interest next time.
Okay.
All right, so we'll wrap it up here. Thanks again.
You're welcome. I hope if anybody listens to this, they find it helpful and worth thinking about.
I hope also moderately entertaining. I mean, some of it is quite sad and bitter, but I think it helps if you can have a sense of humor about some of it as well. I think we do. We mm-hmm. still have a healthy view of some of these shenanigans.
Yep. and don't lose sight of the of the assessment or the interaction with these major cultural or philosophical trends that have so affected people,
mm-hmm.
and that have affected the way people think and look at reality that's markedly different than it was a couple generations ago.
Well, and the lack of awareness as well. And when you do point it out, it's as if people don't have the frame of reference to discuss it. Although Keith Manis, I think, would, but he wasn't willing to engage, or just mm-hmm. didn't accept the premise that saying two mutually exclusive things are both valid. Yeah, I don't think he was mm-hmm. willing to have that discussion. But other people, I think, just are so unaware and don't have the tools to self-assess.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just kind of at the mercy of their ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Worldview does that unless it's critically evaluated, unless it's appraised and evaluated compared with other worldviews. It's like the fish being in water. They don't know that they're in water. Shot through the heart, and you're to blame. You give up.